The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So what I'd like to talk about today is how this chant that we sang together, this very beautiful chant, really are actually instructions for how to live a life of goodness. And it's often the case that we hear something that it was written down that the Buddha said, and we think, oh, that's pretty cool. But we don't really get that. These are instructions. This is how to do it. So the first part of the chant, for living a life without, regrets, essentially, a life of non-harming, a life characterized by goodwill. And the word loving kindness, which is metta, M-E-T-T-A, in Pali, actually means no ill will. It means friendliness. It's a kind of living without wanting to harm either ourselves or others. So it doesn't have to be. It's sometimes close to the Christian notion of agape, but it's even a little, the bar is even a little lower on this one. Because it's essentially choosing to live without ill will, without wishing harm for another. So you might not have a lot of positive feelings for another, for a difficult person. But we can often, with practice, get to the point of not wishing that person to be harmed. So that's kind of the basis for loving kindness practice. And as we practice it, it can become more and more energized and expansive. But sometimes when people hear about this, this just seems so difficult that, you know, I cannot have loving kindness toward that person. Well, can you practice with cultivating no ill will? So this tells us how to do it, essentially. The first part of the chant contains the instructions around personal development, the attitudes and virtues we should cultivate to live harmoniously within our own minds as well as with other beings. So it begins, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. So a skillful person is one who intends and practices non-harming. And for those of you who have studied the Buddha's Eightfold Path, you know that wise intention is the second part in the path, where we practice generosity, no ill will, and renunciation. So in this, in intention, we have this intention to renounce harming, this intention of letting go. And what we let go to in order not to harm is our attachment to views. It's not that we can't have views and opinions. All human beings have views and opinions. And I think even my dogs have views and opinions. It's a really natural thing for creatures. But what we need to be careful about is our attachment to them, our identification with them, our unwillingness to recognize them as views, and to be willing to hold them with a certain degree of lightness is probably not the right word. But years ago, when I was in college, I remember reading Gandhi saying that he could not ask his opponents to change any more than he in his own heart was willing to change. And that just, it's probably the thing that stuck out for me most in my entire college education as an undergraduate was, and I thought, is that possible? Is it possible for someone to engage with another person with that intention that you would be willing to give up what you were hanging on to if you learned that it was incorrect, and to really, really hold that as a value? So this is when we talk about attachment to views and renunciation. really being willing to have views and opinions, but always being willing to look at them and to examine them. So letting go is letting go of our attachment to views, to indulgence in sense pleasures, to rites and rituals. It's really interesting to think about when the Buddha talked about, you know, what it is that we hang on to. It's sort of sensual indulgence, our notion that we should be comfortable. And how often we can think in our society, we say, well, I'm just not comfortable with that, as if comfort is kind of the most important value, or at least a very important value. Letting go of rites and rituals. And this had a pretty specific meaning in the Buddha's time around some sort of Brahmin practices. But we can think of our own little rites and rituals that we hang on to, whether it's, you know, the perfect cup of coffee the first thing in the morning and how our morning is just wrecked if that doesn't happen. Or you know, to things that are more serious, being recognized, the ritual being recognized in a certain sort of way at your workplace, whatever. So you can just think about what are the rites and rituals that you are attached to. You know, when someone takes what you regard as like your place in the meditation hall. So, and this is the path of peace. I mean, that's the whole, we let go of these things because this is the path to living a more peaceful and liberated life. Letting go of the need to be right. You know, how often it's more, you know, is it more important to be kind than to be right? And I don't know how many of you saw that movie, The Descendants, the George Clooney movie. But in this movie, George Clooney's wife, who has been in a boating accident, she's having an affair, a lot of things, and that she was, he finds out after she's in the hospital and unresponsive, and they're about to take her off life support. And her father just goes after him and says, you know, you are a terrible husband. You should have bought her that boat and all these kinds of things. And he's found out that his wife has betrayed him. And I thought, okay, this is the movie where, you know, he then just explodes and says to the father, you know, she did all these things to me. This is a result of her having, you know, an affair. This is all, you know, she's here in this hospital because she was having an affair out in someone's boat, yada, yada, yada. But, and I was assured that that was going to happen because this is an American movie. And instead, the George Clooney character just says to the father, who's so angry as his daughter is about to be taken off, you know, he said, you're right. And he just, it's, you know, an incredible act of kindness. This is a man who's losing his daughter. And instead of being right, he's willing for this person just to dump on him completely and just say, you're right. So, I mean, I always thought that was such an extraordinary moment of someone being kind rather than being right, letting go of that need to be right. And this is also such a good reminder for us that, you know, a lot of our suffering in our mental states is we just go over and over and over our need to be right or that we were right. And, you know, if we can renounce hanging on to that, especially in our own mental conversations with ourselves, we would be a lot more peaceful. So the path of peace is internal as well as outwardly manifest. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. And this instructs us to live with integrity and candor. Transparency, saying what we truly mean, but saying it in a way that's not intended to cause harm, not speaking out of ill will. So that's our challenge, to be transparent, to speak candidly, to stand up, say what we mean, but not to do it out of ill will. And when the Buddha talks about wise speech, his guidance is to question yourself, is it true? Is what you're about to say true? Is it a useful thing to say? Not like, I told you that. I told you that would happen. Probably not useful. Is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? And this is another really important area to develop sensitivity. We might have something to say to a friend or a partner, someone who comes to us for guidance, but at that time, that person is unable to really hear what it is that we have to say. We have something that's true, we have something that might be useful, but the person is in such a state that maybe all they need at that time is comfort and kindness. So is it timely? And then finally, is it rooted in goodwill? Are we saying something to a person, even if it's something that's really difficult to say? Are we saying it out of a sense of non-harming? Non-harming to ourselves, not harming to others. Humble and not conceited. Contented and easily satisfied. Humility comes from knowing that we often don't know. That our understanding is often partial and incomplete, and that we are creatures of our conditioning. May we find, there's a wonderful metta phrase in a different metta practice that I sometimes use. May we find forgiveness for the inevitable harms we bring to one another. We think about this, for example, in the arena of microaggressions, of misunderstandings around race and culture, of working out of a certain sort of racial frame, sometimes being unaware of racial privilege. And we need to have some humility about that, that often we are acting out of our conditioning and out of our ignorance. Contented, humble, and not conceited. The word for that usually gets translated as conceit in English is a word in Pali that is mana, M-A-N-A. And what that means in, when the Buddha used that word mana, it means no comparisons. I'm not better than, worse than, not the same as. All the kinds of comparisons that we make of ourselves with others, where we're ranking ourselves. And a lot of times, we're figuring out where we are in the order of things, whether it's in our families, in our work, in our organizations. It's probably more benign in sports, maybe. But, it's sort of when we're personally judging other people all the time and ranking ourselves. So that's really what this idea of conceited is. It's not just self-aggrandizing, which is the way we usually think of it in English, but conceited is really making all these comparisons all the time. And this is a pretty usual pattern for a lot of us. Is that person better looking than I am? Is that person smarter? All of these sorts of things. And we do it so habitually. We don't do it because we're bad people. We do it just out of our conditioning. And if we can recognize this and let go of that, there's a lot less mental suffering. So these are all causes of suffering. And they, if we're always comparing and ranking, we're solidifying our identification with self, and that's really unhelpful. Contented and easily satisfying. Appreciating what is good and beneficial in this moment. Hearing the Dharma. Having access to the requisites. Right now we all have access to food. This is my assumption, and please forgive me if I'm making, if it's not applied, to food, to shelter, to clothing. But most of us in this room, I believe, have access to that. So being satisfied, realizing that, we all somehow got here this morning. What good fortune. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. And it's not that we have to abandon our responsibilities, our duties, but we're not burdened with them. If it's if we can engage with our responsibilities without resentment, realizing this is the way it is, whether it is caring for a parent or a partner or a child who has a lot of needs, requires a great investment of time, of resources, whether it's a job that has a lot of responsibilities. It's not that we have to get rid of our duties and responsibilities, but can we be with them in a way that they are less burdensome, that we recognize, oh, this is how it is right now. This is how it is right now. And to add on the suffering. And it's so important to say, this is so hard. And we should have a lot of compassion for ourselves when we're in sort of difficult circumstances where we have a lot of responsibilities, a lot of compassion, saying, this is so difficult. But that's different than really being resentful that we have these duties or these responsibilities. And the resentful part is the toxicity. That's really the burden. In a slightly different perspective, frugality is a way of unburdening ourselves. Not having a lot of stuff to maintain, which is burdensome. All the things, everything you get, you have to kind of clean, maintain, find a place for. So letting go of what doesn't support our aspirations. Entertainments and distractions that undermine our mindfulness. You know, that when we just sort of numb out, and we can do it with food or binge watching, or you know, we just kind of stuff other sensory input in. And that really is burdensome, and it is not conducive to our aspirations. So you can just think about, you know, what is it that you maintain, that you do, that you might be able to let go of, and you would feel more content. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. So this is the fruit of living with mindfulness, that you're peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. That we have calm in our own hearts. And this is impossible if we are self-obsessed, self-aggrandizing, and demanding other people to do our bidding. We all probably know really high-maintenance people. We may be a high-maintenance person ourselves. And you know, you can think about how letting go of some of that is letting go of a kind of mental suffering. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And it's really helpful sometimes to think of someone that you really admire, that seems to you to be a person who lives with great integrity. And it could be someone you know, or it could be, you know, many people regard the Dalai Lama, for example, as an example of someone who lives with great integrity. Barack Obama might be someone else that some people hold as someone who has achieved a high personal standard of integrity. And it's really helpful sometimes to imagine, imagine how that person might see what we are about to do or to say. So for example, something is just, you find something as you're walking and you see sort of a beautiful scarf has fallen in the snow. And you say, well, finders keepers. And you don't sort of hang it on a fence nearby or something so that someone who comes back and looks at it. So how would you feel if the person you most admired saw you do that? So I mean, we can just think about it in this sort of way. And this is actually one of the instructions that the Buddha had when he talked with his son about, you know, if you make a mistake, you think something's not going to be harming, and ends up harming Find someone who's wise. Find someone who has integrity. Get the advice of that person. So it's really useful in our lives to have ideas of persons who live lives with great, great integrity. And when we're questioning what we should do, you know, like, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to make some more copies for myself on the office copier. Is that something you would do in front of that person? And it's just really, and sometimes we go ahead and do it anyway. But, you know, it's a way just of really bringing a kind of mindfulness and integrity to our own practice, because this helps us live more harmoniously. I mean, that's what this is about. It's living more harmoniously, living without a lot of mental stress, a lot of mental suffering. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. And when we live the life of integrity and frugality and non-harming for ourselves and others, we find ourselves feeling a sense of moral safety, a sense of gladness. When we are at peace with ourselves, loving kindness toward others can flow more naturally. So the whole purpose, this first part of this chant, is all about how to help ourselves live with ease and gladness. And then we're really totally primed to offer loving kindness to other beings. The middle part of the sutta, the chant, teaches the scope and practice of loving kindness, which is no ill will. And it invites us to be really imaginative in just thinking, how far could this go? Sometimes loving kindness and the other varieties of love, loving kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy and equanimity, they're called the immeasurables, the boundless qualities. We can never have too much of them. And so the Buddha says, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the greater the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. So we are encouraged to consider all sentient life, human beings in all stations and conditions, all creatures visible or unrecognized, micro, macro, known or unknown, near or distant. Like I think of, you know, doing metta in the way, and when I come to this, I think about, oh yeah, there are people on the space station, you know, near and far away in the space station. There are people we could send our loving kindness to. May all beings existing now or to exist in the future, may all be at ease, be without strife. So this also, I mean, we can think of immediately, there are lots of ways to apply this. I have family and friends in far-flung parts of the world. And so in the morning, you know, when I do this, I feel really connected with them. I remember them. I send them loving kindness, even though they're really far away. And it just is such a great sense of connection. I have a young friend who's pregnant, and I think, oh, born and about to be born, sending loving kindness. So we can really take this and just bring our good wishes, wishes for living without strife, living in peace, living in harmony, to all these beings. And this idea about born and to be born, thinking about what we need to do to live with loving kindness for the generations to come. So this is sometimes taken as a real urge to love the planet, to take care of the planet, to take care of the trees. When you take this to heart about loving all the macro and the micro, the near and the far, those currently existing, those that may come into existence, you know, this is a beautiful, beautiful intention for us to send this loving kindness, or you can just think of it as non-harming to all those beings. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. And this is probably the most challenging part of the Buddha's instructions. We personally may work hard not to deceive another and then find that we have been deceived. And our instinctive response might often be to despise the person who deceives us, to hate the person. And this is a cause of suffering. Hanging on to any form of hatred is like taking poison, hoping that it will kill our enemy or our opponent. That's the way the Buddha talks about hatred. It's like taking poison and hoping it's going to harm someone else. Some of you may have heard of the psychologist and marriage guru, John Gottman. And he always says, you know, the most toxic quality that a person can have in a relationship is contempt, right? When we have contempt for each other, for another person, it is almost impossible for us to have a relationship with that person. And we can just maybe remember times that we have contempt for someone and just feel the burn of that. If we have contempt, it is just wanting another to be harmed or to suffer because we are angry or filled with hatred. That's really different than wanting someone to be brought to justice, to have an appropriate response, a way of sort of repairing the harm that has been done. But we do it not out of this sense of really wanting another to suffer. It's that the Jewish notion of tikkun, you know, repairing the world. So what we can want is for repair to be done, but wanting it out of a sense of hatred is always harming to ourselves. So when we're in that position of just finding ourselves consumed with anger or resentment, the best thing to do, I think, is to really practice self-compassion, which is to acknowledge how difficult it is, to acknowledge the suffering in this mental state, and to understand that other people suffer with this too. We're not the only person who is struggling with this sort of disappointment, with anger, with whatever that unskillful mind state is. We can have some self-compassion and realize how difficult it is to be someone suffering with this. And this is what human beings suffer with. I mean, we realize that we're not the only one. And then we can really try to practice some loving kindness toward ourselves. So just as in the first part of this sutta, you know, it's about sort of taking care of yourself, of developing these qualities in yourself. And so if we go back to sort of developing those qualities in ourselves, we're more likely to be able to let go of the hatred. We can also always recognize that we all reap the consequences of our intentions and our own mental states. We can experiment with noting how we feel when we don't have ill will, when we're stopping harmful actions, when we're seeking justice, when we're protecting others. None of this requires ill will. And there's a book out, came out a couple of years ago, called The Gandhian Iceberg. Kind of odd title, but really talks about taking this in. We don't need anger or hatred to do the right thing. We really don't need anger or hatred to do the right thing. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And this beautiful image of maternal love, the willingness to protect another at all costs, gives us another take on how to regard persons whom we are tempted to despise. Ideally, and I know, again, this may not be true for some persons here who have had, it may be painful if you have not had good mothering experiences. If you had a mother who was cruel or withholding, or if you've had inadequate mothering. But for persons who have had good mothers or who are good mothers to recognize that sense of what a beautiful and beneficial thing that sort of fierce maternal mother bear energy is, to really protect another, to protect that child from self-harming, from harming others, and to love the child even when the child is acting out in the most terrible ways. And you know, some people live with children who are simply unable to control themselves, and they may always be that way because of neurological issues, and to still love that child, even though that child can't respond with affection, even though that child acts out. If we hold that as a kind of image in our minds and say, could we do that? Can we love another even though that other is acting out all the time, is not appreciating us? That would be to wish that being no harming. So you can imagine, perhaps you can imagine an adult who may act out publicly a lot seems unrestrained, uncontrolled. Can we still wish that person not have harm? Can we be willing to try to protect that person from harming himself or herself and others? And that's what the mother tries to do. It's to protect, she not only protects the child, but tries to protect the child from harming the child itself or others. Loving kindness encourages us to develop a boundless heart with regard to all living beings and regard all living beings as worthy of our concern. And I think about this as we talk about Mother Earth, Gaia, and our relationship to the environment, again, having that sort of protecting energy. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. And whenever we get to this part in the chanting, I just always feel chills like that. It's, what an aspiration. You know, radiating kindness over the entire world, upward to the skies, downward to the depths, freed from hatred and ill will. So our loving kindness can be boundless once we are freed from hatred and ill will. And this is an incredible freedom. This is the liberation. The mind, our minds, liberated from the torments of ill will, the suffering of wishing harm to another. And we can just watch in our own minds what it's like, the suffering our minds have when we are wishing harm toward another. And when we can let go of that, to just feel what a liberation that is, that absence of suffering. Then the Buddha concludes, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, we should sustain this recollection. This is the sublime abiding. So when we are mindful, we're not drowsy, we're not drifting off, but we're mindful. When we're mindful in any of the bodily postures, we should cultivate this attitude of loving kindness. And sometimes loving kindness and compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity are called the heavenly abodes. We abide in them, and that we can always go to one of these mental states of kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And that's what we do. So this is the sublime abiding. We abide in loving kindness. We abide in compassion or sympathetic joy or equanimity. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted ones, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, are not born again into this world. In this conclusion, we circle back to the beginning, the qualities of the person who is skillful in goodness, abandoning our clinging to our opinions and ideas by letting go of ill will, by purifying our hearts, by practicing mindfulness. This is the clarity of vision, the mindfulness. Letting go of our infatuation with comfort and sensual indulgence. In this way, we step out of this cycle of suffering, of causing harm to ourselves and others, and we can actually dwell in the heavenly abode of loving kindness. So we have some time before the children come in, so I would love to hear your comments, your experiences in working with this, your questions if you have them. Oh, okay. And into the mic directly.
Are there any Buddhist philosophies that define what's right or wrong? Because isn't right or wrong a fixed view most of the time? So, or do they prefer to look at what's skillful or unskillful? And is unskillful wrong and is skillful right? Do they define right or wrong?
That's a great question, and you've partly answered it. It's more useful to talk about skillful and unskillful than right or wrong. And the Buddha said he came to teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And that's combined. So we look at what causes suffering, what causes harm. And that's the way we make judgments about what's appropriate to do or not to do. So it's in different circumstances, we may be called to do very different kinds of things. Sometimes we, out of our kindness, might speak more clearly and directly to someone who maybe just sort of blowing things off. You really need to hear this. You really need to hear this right now, and it may be unpleasant. Okay. Other times we would not speak in that sort of a tone to a person. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Great question. And your name is?
Gabriel.
Okay, thank you, Gabriel. And this goes to Jesse.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I thought that it was one of the things that stood out to me was, not doing things for humility. It isn't humiliation, is it? As just acknowledging that, you know, there are still things that are not, that we have an experience or that we don't know, that we don't have to fit into a mold of being totally perfect or flawless in every way. And also that being motivated by even to do things that are good and are helpful, it's not being motivated by wanting to control everything or being motivated by guilting. I think if I understood that right, part of the talk was about, you know, really being motivated by genuine reasons rather than being motivated in kind of an ill way, I guess. And I thought that was important. So even if it seems like, even if somebody is doing something that is helpful, you know, are they being motivated by their own greedy type of ways, or is it that they're really well from within and that they have that to offer? So I thought that those were some good points.
And sometimes we have really mixed mixed motivations. And I used to spend a lot of time thinking, well, which one is it really? Like, well, they're both there. I know that, you know, if I do this, I will be praised, I'll be seen a certain way. But I also really, really want to do it for its own sake. So it's kind of getting the self out of the way in that is really helpful. I also want to say that, and I think this is really important for Buddhists to take to heart, and the children are here, and I'll be quick with this. We always take refuge in intention, and we can take refuge in our good intentions, but we always really need to recognize what the impact is. And we might have had good intentions and really harmed another. And you see this a lot around issues of race and privilege. And we really need to take responsibility for the impact and to look to understand often that our intentions were inadequately informed. We had these good intentions, but we're really ignorant, and we need to do some more. So the children are here. Thank you all for your very kind attention, and we'll chant with the children.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.